You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. It's happened to all of us. Right before an important presentation, the printer runs out of ink. Brother Inkvestment tank printers help put a stop to this and can literally change the way you ink. With your choice of 1 or 2 years of ink included in box, Inkvestment tank helps eliminate the expense and hassle of frequently buying and replacing ink cartridges. Learn more at changethewayyouink.com. What makes a data breach the worst breach of all time? How about losing our social security numbers, the keys to our identities? How about losing 145 million of them? Breach is a podcast that takes you inside the world's biggest hacks, how they're done, who does them, and what's really at stake when your private data is compromised. And this season, they're investigating the worst breach ever, Equifax. Listen to Season 2 of Breach, the Equifax story. This time it's personal. Subscribe to Breach, that's B-R-E-A-C-H, in your podcast app right now. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Divisive politicians, screaming heads on television, angry campus activists, Twitter trolls. Today in America, there's an outrage industrial complex that prospers by setting American against American. Meanwhile, 1 in 6 Americans have stopped talking to close friends and family members over politics. Millions are organizing their social lives and curating their news and information to avoid hearing viewpoints differing from their own. Ideological polarization is at higher levels than any time since the Civil War. Indeed, my guest today says America has developed what he calls a culture of contempt, a habit of seeing people who disagree with us not as merely incorrect or misguided, but as worthless. He's best-selling author, social scientist, and president of the American Enterprise Institute, Arthur Brooks. In a new book, Arthur shows that treating others with contempt and outraging the other side is not a formula for lasting success, and he offers a new way to lead based not on attacking others, but on bridging national divides and mending personal relationships. His book is called Love Your Enemies: How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. And today, Arthur returns to the podcast to talk about the event that woke him up to the ugliness of our political discourse 2.5 years before the 2016 election, and what he thought about President Trump's 2-hour rant at last week's CPAC conference. He pulls back the curtain on how political parties are pushing us farther apart, and how talking heads in the media are profiting from stoking divisiveness and hate. Arthur reveals the connection between frequent commenting on social media and personality disorders, and how he handles angry emails and Twitter trolls. He shares what we can learn about civility from the Dalai Lama and a leading marriage counselor. We discuss the power of stories to bridge divides and the necessity of the competition of ideas to a healthy democracy. Plus, the time Arthur got mistaken for a Mormon and loved every minute of it, and why this free market conservative says everyone needs a friend like Cornel West. Coming up with Arthur Brooks in just a moment. Arthur C. Brooks is president of the American Enterprise Institute. He is also an op-ed columnist for The Washington Post and host of the podcast The Arthur Brooks Show, as well as the author of 11 books, including the bestsellers The Conservative Heart, The Road to Freedom, and his latest titled Love Your Enemies: How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. Arthur, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
Well, I enjoyed this new book, Love Your Enemies, and in it you say that you first noticed the acrid tone of politics about 2.5 years before the 2016 election. You were speaking to a group of conservatives, I think, in New Hampshire. What did you see there that alarmed you?
Well, I knew something was kind of up because, you know, the tone of politics had been going down for a long time, Ben. I think that you've seen that, and I've seen that, and a lot of people listening to us have seen that too. But I kind of figured out the path that we were on for the first time. I was giving a speech in New Hampshire, as you say, and that's what I do for a living. I do, you know, 150 speeches a year, so I'm traveling around a lot, and I talk to a lot of different audiences. This was a conservative activist crowd, however, about 700 conservative activists in New Hampshire, and I was the only speaker on the panel on the day, actually. It was one speech after another that wasn't a presidential candidate. Now, back in those days, it seemed like everybody in America was running for president on the Republican side, and there was something like 16 people and me. And I showed up a little bit early, and I was listening, and they were doing what presidential candidates always do. You know, they were basically saying to sympathetic audiences, you're right, and the other side's stupid, kind of throwing red meat out of the audience. And I thought, huh, I wonder what I can say that would be different, because I don't have to run for anything. And so I tried to make a point that I thought was pretty uncontroversial, even though maybe not popular, which was, and I said in the middle of my speech, look, you know, we all agree here on public policy, on economics and foreign policy and such, but let's remember for a second the people who don't agree with us, and they're not here because they don't agree with us. These are political liberals. And I want you to remember simply that they're not stupid, they're not evil, they're simply Americans who disagree with us about policy. And it wasn't an applause line. But a lady in the audience, she said, I think they're stupid and evil. And it was funny. Wow. Because at that moment, yeah, I know. And at that moment, I thought about my hometown in Seattle. And the reason is because it's the most liberal place. And I come from a liberal family. My mother was an artist. My father was a college professor. I mean, guess what their politics were? Big surprise. And, you know, I'm the black sheep of the family, actually, as a political conservative. And I thought, that lady's... she's speaking with contempt about my mother, and that's not right. And it set me on a path of listening a little bit better and trying to think about the moment that I thought might be upon us, and in fact was, which was this culture of political contempt where we treat each other as utterly worthless. It's not angry at all. It's cold. It's hateful. It's dismissing. And that's where we are today.
Now, you say that you live and work in Washington, but you're not a politics junkie. Your thing is more about ideas, and specifically policy ideas, than politics. And I want to ask you about this weekend's CPAC, because I'll tell you, I don't know if you actually attended this year. I know you have before. And I remember when CPAC used to be a forum for ideas and a wide variety of conservative ideas. When I watched Donald Trump this year on television, it seemed just like a cult of personality and the opposite of what you're advocating in this book. What did you think?
Well,
were you there?
I was not there. I have been there many times in the past. I wasn't invited this year. I think that the message that I'm talking about is not a great fit for what's going on at CPAC, okay, quite frankly. I mean, and partly because I do talk about ideas and I don't just talk about politics, but also I'm talking about how we can love each other and come together as a country. And that's just not, as you suggest, that wasn't the big overarching theme. But I watched it. You know, I watched some of it. I certainly watched the president's speech. And it was kind of what you'd expect from a presidential speech, insofar as that the president was whipping them up and they were loving him and they hope that he gets reelected. Still, I thought it was a huge missed opportunity. It's a missed opportunity for the Republicans who have the White House and they have the Senate. And if things had gone a different way, they could still have the House of Representatives, of course, to bring the country together and to consolidate the influence that they have in a very constructive way. And frankly, you know, when they're locking down the base and saying that the other side is stupid and evil, that's a huge missed opportunity. The reason is because, Ben, you know, we're a 50-50 country,
right,
more or less. And when you say the other side is stupid, you're not persuading anybody and you're just not going to win. The best way to lose right now is to say that the other side is stupid and evil.
Your own journey toward rejecting contempt begins with an email from a man in Texas who actually opened with, "Dear Professor Brooks, you're a fraud." In handling that situation, talk about the three options available to you and how you came to find a fourth option to deal with that kind of trolling.
Thank you for asking, Ben. This was really a big epiphany for me. Actually, it was in 2006, before I came to AEI as president. I was still a professor at Syracuse University, and I had never written a book that anybody had ever read. I'd written a bunch of books, but nobody ever read them because they were very boring. but I wrote a book, and it was boring, but it hit the news cycle in just the right way. And this sometimes happens to college professors, that they write a book, and it catches on fire, and it started selling hundreds of copies a day. And I was on the news. I got to come on television or radio shows, and my life really changed a lot. But the weirdest thing is I started hearing from people who were total strangers and were writing me emails. Now, this doesn't happen to normal people where somebody gets your email and writes you a message. But I was hearing from people who had read my book and were feeding back. And when you see, the weird thing is when you read somebody's book, you feel like you know the person. And so people were talking to me as if they were old acquaintances. Some liked it and some hated it and they didn't mind telling me. Anyway, so this is the environment, just to sort of set the stage. And I'm getting hundreds of these messages. I got an email from a guy like a Wednesday afternoon, a few weeks after the book came out. It starts off just like you said, "Dear Professor Brooks, you're a fraud." Maybe he even said, I can't remember, "You're a right-wing fraud." And which is like, that's a pretty bad way to start email, right?
Yeah.
But I'm game, I'm reading, and I realize very quickly that this email is like 5,000 words long. It's going to take me 20 minutes to get through it. But I'm reading it, and I started noticing, and it was super vitriolic. I mean, you're a moron, everything's wrong, but he was detailed going through every single element of my book, every graph, every chart, every data point, every assertion, and just telling me every single thing was wrong, talking about other sources of data. And I was about 15 minutes into this thing, and I became aware of my emotions, which is pretty rare for me, and I noticed I was full of gratitude because he read my book. And nobody ever read my books. My books, I mean, it was crazy. And so my heart was overflowing with gratitude to this guy who was just ripping me. So I thought, this guy's in Texas. At the time, I was in Syracuse, New York. I got nothing to lose. I'm going to tell him. So I just wrote him back and said, "Dear so-and-so, I know you hate my book and think I'm a total right-wing stooge. But I got to tell you, it took me 2 years to write that thing, and you read the whole book. I'm really grateful to you for that. Thank you. Send." And then I go back to work, right? And 15 minutes later, his response pops back up. Ding. And I'm thinking, now he's going to be really mad. And I open up his email, kind of bracing myself for the next salvo. And he says, "Dear Professor Brooks, next time you're in Dallas, if you want to get some dinner, give me a call." And I thought, what just happened? And what had just happened is something I subsequently came to understand as a behavioral social scientist. The neuroscience of this is very clear. There's an anesthetic effect when you show love, especially in the form of gratitude, to somebody who's showing you contempt. You neutralize their contempt. You change your own heart, and frequently you change theirs as well. And I learned that by accident. And I want everybody who reads my book to know how to do it on purpose. Because if you want to persuade people, you don't persuade them by insulting them. You persuade them by showing them respect and warm-heartedness and love.
Yeah, and perhaps this guy was already conditioned to that because, I mean, let's face it, he was doing something that many of us don't do, which is actually bothering to pick up a book and read an opposing viewpoint.
I know.
And take an interest.
It's so true. My colleague Charles Murray, who's been at the American Enterprise Institute for many, many years before I've been here, he gets ripped up on college campuses all the time from people who say that he's a racist or a pseudoscientist or something. And it's completely clear that they've never read a single word of his books. They've just read on the internet or someplace that he's evil. That's kind of the sign of the times, right, Ben?
Yeah, and in studying this culture of contempt that we're dealing with these days, you talked to a psychologist named Dr. John Gottman, who I think you've talked to on your podcast as well. He claims that he can predict with 94% certainty which couples will divorce within 3 years just by spending an hour or two with them. What kind of things does he look for?
Yeah, so everybody who's listening to us who's married, And maybe we got a lot of young people who are not married, but probably will be married. So take note of this. This guy named John Gottman, he runs the Gottman Marriage Laboratory in Seattle. He's a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle. And as you just heard, he can predict with 94% accuracy within 1 hour whether a couple will be divorced within 3 years. And what he's looking for are signs of contempt. Now, contempt is not anger. Anger is uncorrelated with separation and divorce. Contempt mixes anger with disgust, in which you treat somebody, the person that you should love more than any other person in the world, as if that person were useless. That you do that with sarcasm, you do that with derision, you especially do that with eye rolling, and you usually don't do it on purpose. It's kind of a bad habit. What he finds is that when couples treat each other with contempt, they make each other into enemies, and that's the surest way to take them to divorce court. Now, the reason I put that in the book is because that's how we treat each other in America all the time, on Twitter, in person, and social media, mm-hmm. in the comment sections, we talk to our fellow Americans who, you know, we don't agree with them. And by the way, we shouldn't agree with each other. Places where everybody agrees are mediocre and stagnant. Disagreement, this competition of ideas, leads to excellence and progress. So, and we have a moral obligation not to agree with bad ideas. But when people treat each other with contempt, this conviction that the other person is worthless, will make permanent enemies. And that goes way beyond disagreement. And it makes progress and persuasion totally impossible. It's the stupidest thing that you can possibly do is to treat another person with contempt if you want to have any prayer at convincing the person that you're right.
And he actually says that contempt is physically bad for you, right?
Yeah. I love this. It's so interesting. And it's one of the things that we find today. He finds that contempt is bad. When you feel that somebody's treating you with contempt, especially somebody close to you, that it gives you a lot of anxiety, depression. It leads to loneliness. He also finds that when you treat somebody else with contempt, it leads to much higher stress levels. The cortisol and norepinephrine and epinephrine levels, which are the stress hormones that you feel in your body. When you treat another person with contempt, you actually have higher stress yourself. Now, that's interesting to me because I understand that in the context of couples that are quarreling. But we also see those characteristics in today among people who are really involved in politics, especially people involved in politics on social media. High rates of anxiety, high rates of loneliness, rising rates of depression, and very high rates of stress. Exactly the stuff that John Gottman talks about in Quarreling Couples. So the message is this: don't treat anybody with contempt if you want to win an argument. And second of all, never treat anybody with contempt if you want to be happy and successful. There are zero reasons to behave in this matter if you want to be a happier, better person that wins more arguments.
Yeah, it's interesting that we seem to invest as much in our political beliefs as we do in our marriage and our relationships.
Yeah, sad commentary, right?
Yeah. The other person that you talked to who played a pivotal role in how you approach disagreement is, of all people, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. What did you learn from him?
The Dalai Lama, some of your listeners are more familiar with him than others. The Dalai Lama is the leader of the Tibetan Buddhist people, and he's the most respected religious figure in the world. He lives in Dharamsala in the Himalayan foothills in India. He's been living in exile there since he was since the Chinese communists rolled through Tibet and sent him into exile with the Tibetan leadership. So he's been there for over six decades. The Dalai Lama and I have been friends for about 7 years. We've been working together on various projects, talking about human dignity and human potential. And it's a beautiful friendship. I've learned a lot from him. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm a Catholic. But I have to say that His Holiness, the world's greatest Buddhist, has made me into a better Catholic just because he's such a wonderful, warm, and welcoming person. His Holiness, I was making a documentary film with him that's coming out this spring called The Pursuit, about how to lift people out of poverty and how to find happiness. And I was thinking about this contempt problem while we were shooting this film. And between takes, I asked him, Your Holiness, what should I do when I feel contempt? Because this is the key. If we have a habit of contempt, you got to break the habit by doing something else when you feel it. You can't just stop. Mm-hmm. You have to substitute. Like, you know, when you want to stop smoking, you do something else instead of smoking, right? Like drinking. Anyway.
Hopefully not.
So the Dalai Lama, I asked him this question, what should I do when I feel contempt? And he said, show warm-heartedness. And I thought, well, that sounds kind of weak. You know, that's, you know, come on, man. But then I thought about it, and he does that. Look, the Chinese communists rolled through Tibet, kicked him out with complete violence, killed a ton of people, and led him in total poverty to be disappeared and forgotten. This is what tyrants always do. And over the next six decades, he became a world leader and the world's most respected religious figure? How? And the answer is by practicing warm-heartedness, by showing people the love that you can express even when you're an exiled figure. He starts every day praying for the Chinese leaders, not that they'll give him back his homeland, but they'll live good and happy lives, notwithstanding what they've done. And I thought, man, warm-heartedness, when people treat you with contempt, when people treat you with hate, answer with love. That's incredibly subversive, and that is incredibly tough as well. It's such good advice. It's such good strategic advice, but it's also incredible tough advice. If you want to be the master of yourself, choose your response when somebody treats you with contempt. If you choose the right response, you'll change your own heart. You'll be happier. You'll be more successful. You'll win more arguments, and you'll be more like the Dalai Lama. Imagine that.
Yeah, and when you look at all of the most successful civil rights revolutions, whether it's Gandhi or Mandela or Martin Luther King Jr., they all seem to follow that path more than a path of violence and contempt.
It's true. And, you know, there are times where even compassionate leaders, even leaders who refuse to exhibit personal contempt toward others, that they have to engage in violence when they have to engage in war. There is just war. It actually exists. But the point is basically, especially inside our country, there's no excuse ever for treating a person with contempt. Lots of reasons to express contempt about ideas. You know, some ideas are terrible and we need a competition of ideas. You know, I recommend being gentle about expressing your disagreement with ideas because you want to persuade other people. But the best way to lose an argument is to say that somebody else is worthless. There's never any reason to do that, and there's never any productive reason to do it unless you're just virtue signaling to some gang on Twitter or you're being self-indulgent.
Now, you're saying that we shouldn't vilify our political enemies or let's say those with whom we disagree, but what if we're standing up for something that we believe to be a moral imperative? If our case is a moral one, then it's only logical that we would see the opposing view as an immoral opposing view, right?
Yeah, well, and the answer is sort of yes and no. And it's okay. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. There are cases in which people make just overwhelmingly and obviously immoral arguments, arguments that are racist, arguments that are just hateful toward other people. But once again, people are not their ideas. You can say, I completely dismiss that argument, but I can do it without dismissing another human being. And the problem that we have today in our moral discourse, in our political discourse, is that we don't separate people from ideas. And as such, we're dismissing people and insulting people and treating people with contempt as opposed to taking their ideas on their merits. And that's a really stupid thing to do because once again, what you've done is you've made an enemy as opposed to being able to get into a debate. Now, the second point, and this is an interesting one and one I know you're alluding to, is that a lot of times when we just decide that somebody's ideas are immoral, part of the problem with that is that people have different moral bases for making their decisions. Almost everybody believes morally in both compassion and fairness. Now, we don't define those things in the same way, but liberals and conservatives and moderates and centrists pretty much all believe in compassion and fairness. But psychologists find very interestingly that beyond that, there are some differences, particularly between conservatives and liberals. Conservatives are very interested morally in loyalty and in purity and authority and respect for authority, whereas liberals don't really care very much about those things. And that means they have a sort of different moral foundations. If you want to make an argument that can actually appeal to everybody, or at least conceivably appeal to everybody, keep talking about compassion and fairness. And if you're talking about something like authority or loyalty and a liberal thinks that it's all wrong, it's not because that person is immoral. It just means that those are dimensions in which conservatives and liberals tend to differ. And of course, you disagree with them on that point, but make no mistake, this is not because they're immoral. It just means they have a different set of moral foundations.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Arthur Brooks when we come back in just a minute. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment and get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential. And it's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/kick. Then, simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/kick. One more time, betterhelp.com/kick. And now, back to the show. In your book, you call out the outrage industrial complex that feeds our addiction to political contempt. Do you have a list of the worst offenders on both sides?
Yeah. You know, they're so easy to find. The outrage industrial complex, as I calculated, is about 7% of the population. So it's leaders at all different levels.
Really?
You know, it can be folks at work and it can be people on, you know, cable TV. It can be, you know, somebody in your family, or it can be somebody who's at the highest level of elective office. And what it is basically, the way I calculate this is I have data that show that 93% of Americans hate how divided we become as a country. They have strong opinions. I have super strong opinions. But they don't think that we should hate our neighbors. The other 7% are sort of profiting in some way, either through fame or fortune or power or prestige, or maybe just getting clicks on Twitter and the internet for outrageous opinions that polarize us one from the other. That 7% is how I kind of derisively, but mostly I'm just, you know, amusing myself by calling this the outrage industrial complex. These are people who are profiting from our bad feelings and kind of using us. So what our listeners can do to figure out how to fill in, you know, the cast of characters in this is think of somebody in public life that is profiting from making people hate each other. You know, get a picture of that person in your head, and now that's wrong. And the reason is because you just thought of somebody that you disagree with. So do it again and think of somebody you agree with, your favorite columnist maybe, who's always saying that the other side is stupid and evil, whereas you're always right, your favorite cable show host, who's saying, you're right, they're terrible all the time. Those are the characters that you really need to mute, because they're not expanding your worldview. They're not teaching you anything. What they're doing is they're helping you to excrete a little bit of dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter that gives you a little bit of an addiction. It scratches your confirmation bias. It makes you feel a little bit pious. And that's extremely unhelpful. It's basically like smoking a cigarette. You shouldn't do that, and you certainly shouldn't reward the companies that are getting rich through the stuff that's actually bad for you and make it harder for you to get along with your family and your neighbors. And again, Ben, here's a piece of data that I want people to chew on. When I say not getting along with your family and neighbors, note that 1 in 6 Americans has stopped talking to a family member or close friend because of the 2016 election. This is really bad. I mean, it's bad for happiness. It's bad for people's lives. And it's totally unnecessary, because if these are the people that you think most need to be persuaded, you got to be in the game with those people, man. I mean, these are the people that need most to hear from you. Don't cut them off.
Talking about how the outrage industrial complex fuels this culture of contempt, you say that, number one, we need to refuse to be used by the powerful. Don't allow yourself to be manipulated by political leaders and the talking heads of this industrial outrage complex. But here's the thing, Arthur. I don't think that a lot of people actually believe that they're being manipulated, whether it's by Sean Hannity or by Rachel Maddow. My question, I guess, is how do you convince people that they're being used, or how do we recognize it in ourselves?
Part of it is thinking about what you would most like. You know, if there is somebody, an old friend that you're not talking to that you really miss, think, what would I prefer to do at 9 o'clock tonight? Watch that screaming talk show host on MSNBC or Fox? Or spend an hour with that old friend that I've stopped talking to since the 2016 election, doing the things that we used to do, having laughs, playing poker, having a bourbon on the rocks. You know, what do I wish I could be doing if everything were all better? And if the answer is talk to that old friend, as opposed to hearing from somebody on cable TV telling me that my old friend is stupid and evil, then I'm being used. I'm being used for somebody else's fortune, and I'm not having the love in my life that I actually deserve. And the protocol is very clear. You should mute that person who, you know, I understand that it's satisfying. It scratches that itch to watch them. You should mute that person. You should call your old friend and you should say, I'm sorry that something came between us. I want to get back together.
And you also get into how political parties and politicians fuel this contempt. How has the structure of party politics and things like how we draw congressional districts helped to sow divisiveness?
Well, you know, with gerrymandering, which has become so rampant, and it's something that both Democrats and Republicans do, you know, they'll draw congressional districts such that they can guarantee that true believers from their own party don't face very much opposition. The result of that is that in primaries, since you never have to worry about a general election facing an opponent from the other party that might win, primaries start rewarding the most outlandish figures on both right and left. And again, this has nothing to do with whether or not conservatives or liberals are right or wrong. I'm a political conservative and I have pretty conservative views, but I have to recognize that when only 15% of people turn out in primaries in heavily gerrymandered districts, you're going to get the most outraged voices with the most outrageous policy positions all the time. And that's going to reward people that are simply the most angry and disgusted and contemptuous of the people on the other side. That's one of the big things that's structurally that's fueling our contempt crisis.
It's funny because I remember a few years back, Karl Rove used to carry around a card in his pocket and he would point to the statistics from, I think, the past 10 elections. And there was this 11% of independents. And he would say, that's where you win elections. It doesn't seem like that's the case anymore. It seems like it's become entirely about turning out your base rather than persuading the independents or crossover voters.
There's a lot more of that, to be sure. But there, you know, you still have that 11%, but what you find in a small handful of congressional districts in a small handful of states that really, really are still purple, and they're turning either red or blue as fast as the gerrymanderers can possibly get it done. That's not always going to be the case, however. I mean, populations change, people move. We're going to actually see more mixing as the years go by. I certainly think we're not going to see less mixing. And we're also going to have more of a taste from Americans. You know, when I see 93% of the population say they hate how divided we become, when in every audience I speak before, I say, how many of you love somebody with whom you disagree politically? And 100% of the hands go up. I say, we don't like this. This is making us depressed. It's making us anxious. It's making us stressed out. You know, I understand that this can go on for a little while, but you know, how is it that the most famous and prestigious political candidates in the country are polling at between 30 and 40% popularity? You know, these are the people that should be, especially in a really good economy. How is that possible? And the answer is we don't like the status quo. And in a democratic capitalist society where markets really matter a lot, we're not going to put up with it forever. So woe be unto the 7%, because we're the 93% and we're going to strike back.
But politicians fear that if they don't throw that red meat to the base or go on the attack against their opponents, that they're going to be seen as weak or maybe even get primaried by the extremists in their own party.
Yeah.
In this current climate, isn't that a valid concern?
It is absolutely a valid concern. And so what I'm suggesting is that we need that it takes a lot of courage. You know, I'm not going to act as if this is somehow a layup, because if it were a layup, I wouldn't have had to written the book. This is something that's going to take courage for politicians, but more importantly, it's going to take courage from citizens, because everybody listening to us is a leader. It doesn't mean you're an elected leader or have a $15 million cable TV contract or like, you know, Ben Mathis, one of the most popular podcasts in the country on politics. It's you know, maybe it's just influence in your family, influence at your workplace, influence in your community. You're a leader. Everybody's listening to us has some leadership. And our leadership can be exerted with hatred. It can be exerted in a way that polarizes more and it keeps going to this kind of suboptimal equilibrium that we don't like. Or it can be courageous and say, I want something new. I want something better. I'm not going to put up with something that's not as good. Citizens will exert influence through their votes and their voices. And we're going to have to start this movement ourselves. We can't count on politicians to do it on their own.
Yeah, I mean, politicians probably aren't going to be motivated to actually be the first one to make that move and reject contempt unless it's coming from the voters. So you see this as something that's going to have to be a bottom-up movement.
Yeah, you know, all it's interesting. So political movements are always downstream from social movements. Mm-hmm. You know, politicians who consider themselves to be leaders in democracies, especially capitalist democracies, leaders are almost always actually followers, because they're following a demand or something. You know, basically, sure. Politicians have their finger in the air, and when they see that voters really want something or something's becoming really popular, that's when they start talking about it. Kind of like a parade going down the street, and politicians jump in front of it and say, "I had to lead this thing because they needed a leader." Well, all right. I mean, you can call yourself the leader, but you're actually a follower. A much better thing to do is to change the course of the parade, to make the parade different. And that really comes from social movements. It comes from a hunger for something that's good and true. That has happened a lot of times in American history, where after a financial crisis, as sure as spring follows winter, we go to populism. And populism tends to be very bitter and very contemptuous. And out of that, you see a public hunger for something that's more virtuous, a kind of a renewal, a social enlightenment. We see this happening again and again and again. And then politicians say, yeah, I always believed that. I always wanted that. And I think that's the reason I wrote the book, is because I don't want to spend needlessly another 4 or 5 years walking in the wilderness of this contemptuous environment, whether it's on the right or on the left. I mean, I happen to be on the right, but I don't like it on the right. And I really, really hate the idea of, you know, seeing what's going on in the Democratic Party today, which is just as contemptuous and just as populist and just as hateful. I certainly don't want to see that.
And one of the biggest culprits in this culture of contempt is social media. In Love Your Enemies, you cite a Canadian study that showed that habitual commenting on social media strongly correlates with dangerous personality pathologies. What kind of personality disorders were associated with that kind of online behavior?
When people comment a lot on social media, it's highly correlated with sociopathic personality behaviors, disorders,
wow.
Narcissism. Basic sociopathy, like Machiavellianism and very low empathy. This is not what we want to hang around with, of course. And that doesn't mean that every person who ever posts anonymously to Twitter is a sociopath, although it's a very bad practice, because what we find is that anonymous posting in any forum brings out the worst in people. It's what psychologists call de-individuation. And this is a characteristic of our common contemptuous political discourse. People posting on Twitter, on Facebook, commenting after news articles, and just in general, raising havoc, trolling all the time. People who appreciate that, who like that, who enjoy that the most, these are pretty pathological personalities and people we shouldn't hang out with, but they also bring out the worst in each of us, because nobody's perfect. You know, Jordan Peterson has gotten so popular over the last couple of years, speaking basic truths about a lot of things, and one of them is that we all have little darkness inside of us, and to be a true master of ourselves, we have to recognize that evil can come out of us, and we have to dominate it. And one of the best ways to do it is to stay off of anonymous social media, never participate in that, never talk to anybody who's anonymous, and never participate anonymously. That is one of the key factors in being the master of oneself.
And in talking about the differences between how we behave when we're anonymous versus when we have an identity, you recall an amusing story about a time when you inadvertently took on the identity of a Mormon and actually began to change your behavior to adapt to that identity. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, it wasn't on social media, actually. It was
right.
It was in person, but it could have been on social media for that matter. I had been... You know, I was giving a speech at Brigham Young University, where I speak a lot. As a matter of fact, I'll be the commencement speaker for Brigham Young this spring, this coming May. And I was giving a speech some years ago at Brigham Young, which I love. They're wonderful people. And that was giving me a lot of stuff. They gave me T-shirts and mugs and cool stuff that says Brigham Young on it. And this one particular trip, they gave me an Italian briefcase that said Brigham Young University on it. I thought, huh, it's great. I put it in my briefcase. I put it in my suitcase, I should say, and I folded it up and brought it home. And I showed it to my wife. She said, that's nice. And I threw it in the closet because I didn't need one. So come a month later, the handle on my briefcase breaks. And I'm kind of annoyed about that because it was sort of new. And my wife said, well, don't complain about it. Just go to the closet and get that Mormon briefcase that they gave you. And I said, I don't know. She says, are you afraid people are going to think that you're Mormon? And I said, no, kind of. But I didn't want to be, you know, challenged like this. So I went to the closet. And by the way, I should note that to say Mormon is antiquated. You know, it's the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And, you know, we're saying this right. in the vernacular. But I went to the closet and I got my Latter-day Saints briefcase out and I started carrying it around. And I'm in the airport all the time because I fly all the time. I'm traveling for work. And I noticed that people would look at my briefcase and look at me. And you could kind of watch the wheels turning in their heads. Like, that's a weird looking Mormon. You know, I've never seen an aging hipster Mormon before, you know, kind of. And And then I noticed that I started acting like a Latter-day Saint, or at least I thought one would. I was super nice. I was really well-mannered. I was, you know, giving up my place in line. And, you know, I'm trying not to be a jerk, but it was really raising my standards of manners out in public that people thought I was a Mormon. And it was unbelievable, actually. It just shows that when you're acting like, if people think that you're something other than who you are, it can make you worse than you were if you're anonymous on Twitter. It can make you better than you were if you're carrying a Brigham Young University briefcase. So I recommend that everybody carry a Brigham Young University briefcase from now on.
Yeah. And you also relate this to the power of stories and the danger when people don't have a story and the importance of persuading people through stories. In fact, you say that facts don't usually persuade people very well, but stories do. I have to ask, because it seems like facts are already under dangerous assault as it is right now. Doesn't this lead us down a dangerous path where we rely more on anecdotal evidence versus facts? In other words, a story of one person who was murdered by a violent gang member from Mexico might be more powerful than broader statistics that might show that immigrants, illegal or otherwise, actually commit fewer violent crimes than the general population.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right on that. You know, my friend Ben Shapiro always says that facts don't care about your feelings. Right. And is absolutely right. And there's nobody better at pointing that out than Ben Shapiro. But one of the things I would also point out is that, unfortunately, people's feelings don't care very much about my facts. I can cite facts till the cows come home. I literally have a PhD in quantitative methods and policy analysis. You know, I can set up these models and run these regressions, and I can stuff regression analysis down the gullet of, you know, anybody all day long. I'm unbeatable on these games. But you know what? I lose every argument when I do that, because people want to know about other humans. So what I need to do is I need to say why these things matter, and I have to tell actual human stories. Boy, Ben has revolutionized my work. I mean, when you read the book that we're talking about, Love Your Enemies, it's full of stories, because these are the reasons that these things actually matter. So now when I give a talk about policy analysis, I start by telling a story, sometimes about me, sometimes about other people, but real people whose lives have been touched by policies. And then I talk about what the policies do, and I finish up with more stories. And in so doing, especially if the stories align with the facts, which they must do if I'm an ethical person. See, the cases that you were talking about were anecdotes about a violent gang member. They supersede the actual data on relatively low crime statistics from immigrants, even illegal immigrants. That's an irresponsible, even a dishonest thing to do. Your stories should bolster your facts, and your facts should basically steel man your stories. And in so doing, then you can be a lot more. And if you don't show contempt, if you show love for other people, in so doing, you're pretty much unbeatable rhetorical force.
Now, as president of AEI, I know that you've long been a proponent of economic competition, but you also discuss the competition of ideas as being fundamental to a healthy democracy. That makes a lot of sense because, you know, if we're siloed in our own little echo chambers on social media, surrounded by people who agree with us, we're being intellectually lazy and we're not exercising our persuasive abilities, which I have to imagine makes it a lot harder to articulate our beliefs if we're actually challenged eventually.
That's right. You know, the competition of ideas is really fundamental to a free society. It's the difference between American excellence and mediocrity in so many other places in the world. Just as competition leads to excellence in markets and prosperity and free elections, which leads to the blessings of democracy, the competition of ideas means that we learn first when we're not right, that we can share better ideas with other people, including other people around the world. But this is one of the real secrets to American progress. And yet that's one of the things that we're losing. When we basically say, I'm not going to hang out with or listen to anybody who disagrees with me, we've said, I don't believe in competition. That's the same thing as saying we should have one supermarket or one political candidate. Mm-hmm. Anybody who is basically siloing their social media feeds, who's trying to move into an environment where they don't even see other people they disagree with, going to a college where everybody's liberal, that's somebody who's basically saying, I wish we had one supermarket, one airline, one kind of car, and one political candidate. And that doesn't sound good to me.
Well, before we go, you cite the friendship between two Princeton professors who are ideologically polar opposites, Cornel West and Robbie George, and yet they seem to call each other brothers, and they say that they love each other, and they have this deep friendship. You say everyone should find their Cornell or Robbie. Where do we go to find our Cornell or Robbie?
Well, we got to get out of our comfort zones. We got to go places where people actually do disagree with us, and we got to listen with love in our hearts. And one of the things that I recommend is going places where people don't agree with us, whether it's on a college campus or whether it's some place where people look like us, or they're going to a church maybe where we don't know anybody. And it's listening with a lot of respect and love, and talking about things that we really have in common. You know, one of the things that I do when I bring conservatives and liberals together and I want them to understand each other is I ask them to start by talking about their children. Oh, man. I mean, nothing actually creates a bridging identity faster than dad or mom. I mean, it's unbelievable. And after you talk to each other about your kids, now your teenagers are driving you crazy and you're trying to pay for college and you saw your new baby, I'm telling you, it's just really, really hard to hate each other over politics at that point. And so that's how you get your Robbie and your Cornell.
So you're saying the kids are the mutual enemy? Not
yeah. You got
they find common cause.
Spoken good like advice. A good dad, like me.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed the book. Again, it's called Love Your Enemies, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. Arthur Brooks, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it so much.
Thanks again to Arthur Brooks for coming back on the podcast. Order his new book, Love Your Enemies, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Subscribe to The Arthur Brooks Show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow him on Twitter at Arthur Brooks. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already, and if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.